Views on this program are opinions of dental industry experts and not necessarily those of dentist advisors. Opinions shared in the following interview do not constitute personal financial advice. This program is furnished by Dentist Advisors, a registered investment advisor.
This is Dentist Money. Now, here's your host, Reese Harper.
Welcome to the Dentist Money Show, where we help dentists make smart financial decisions. I'm your host, Reese Harper, on site at Yankee Dental Congress 2017, here with my new friend, Lee Slayton from Smart Training. Let's start with some background on how you got into semi-pro football. Okay, we'll just do OSHA compliance and HIPAA instead, all right? I'm just kidding. Tell us a little bit about the background.
Well, actually, football did play into it.
Good. Yes.
The way we got involved in the dental space, I was actually at a football reunion at the University of Tulsa where I played.
Nice.
Back in the 70s.
Cool.
And I'm at a friend's house, backyard.
Okay.
And at the time I was flying commercially, and people automatically assume that you have all this free time on your hands.
Oh, yeah.
If you're a commercial pilot.
Uh-huh.
And so one of my teammates said, you know, we're out in his backyard having a beer, and he says, so Lee, what else do you do besides fly? And I said, well, I work with this compliance company, Smart Training.
Okay.
And we do, you know, OSHA compliance for companies out there. And our bread and butter client is a company with multiple locations, anywhere from 50 to 5,000 employees. So this teammate of mine is a physician, and, you know, we're drinking beer, and after a few minutes he goes, you know, I know there's no way I'm OSHA compliant. Now, he's got this little bitty practice with 8 employees. Well, I know what's coming next, so I just keep drinking. Sure enough, about 10 minutes later, he goes, Lee, would y'all even consider working with a company that's only got 8 employees?
Yeah. Well, it's slightly less than 5,000, but, you know, you got time, right? Yeah.
Right. So what do you tell an old college teammate? So I said, sure, Jim, you know, we'll help you. So the president of the company and I visited my teammate's practice and told him a little about how we envisioned that program. And he said, well, what would something like that cost? And we told him, and he looks at us and he goes, guys, this is a no-brainer. I can't shut down my practice for half a day and do this. And plus, I don't have the expertise like you guys do.
Yeah.
So my boss and I, we went over to the local pancake house and sat down, kind of like Herb Kelleher in Southwest Airlines. We started sketching it out on a napkin. And we thought, okay, maybe we're onto something here. So the next week, we sat down and had the same conversation with my dentist, who happened to be my best friend. He was my squash partner for 10 years. We played in a 6 a.m. squash league, and he was also an airplane partner of mine.
Oh, that's cool.
And we sat down with him, went through the same thing, and got practically the same answer. He goes, how much does something like this cost? And I told him, and he goes, guys, this is a no-brainer. I can't shut down my practice for half a day to do this.
Why not?
For what you're talking about doing it for.
So prior to that, I mean, who are you guys doing this work for mostly?
We started out 25 years ago in oil and gas because the founder of our company was a senior vice president for regulatory compliance for a worldwide oil company, Shell Oil.
That made sense.
And then from there, you know, it's the typical American success story.
Yeah.
You know, the business grew. We got into construction, manufacturing, distribution, and, you know, and then we kind of backed into, if you will, the dental space.
Yeah.
But it's the biggest piece of our business now.
No way. That's interesting. You got, even with all the money in oil, it kind of made more sense to kind of continue to focus on this dental market.
It did.
That's
so now
great.
Now we're in 4 states on the dental side. We're in all 50 states in the other segments.
Industries, yeah.
But
that's
yeah.
great. So tell me a little bit about what's the most common misconceptions that you see in the dental market as it relates to OSHA compliance?
The biggest single one is, and we hear this all the time, is we'll ask a practice owner, you know, how are you taking care of your OSHA compliance? And they go, oh, well, you know, we had that little training session that we do every year, so we're good.
Yeah, a little training session. I think we all know what that is.
So what they don't understand is training, it's an important piece, but it's one leg of a three-legged stool.
Okay.
the other two legs are equally important. Actually, they're more important in a lot of ways. Number one, you know, you're required. It's required. You have to do a job hazard assessment every year. The way we do that is we actually interview one person from each job classification.
Within the practice.
We talk to them about the instruments they use, the tasks they perform. And if you don't do that, there's no way to really create that roadmap, if you will, of what a safety program should
be. So what is a job hazard? Like, you do these job hazard interviews with people. What are you looking for?
So it's broken up into two components: instruments they use, tasks they perform. So, for instance, one thing we'll ask them about is for instruments used, we'll ask them, hey, do you handle unsheathed hypodermic needles?
Uh-huh.
Do you handle probes? Do you use suction?
Yeah.
And then as far as tasks go, do you administer injections?
Uh-huh.
Do you work in a clinical area where bodily fluids could splash on
mm-hmm.
you? Those are the things that, you know, and a lot of them are the same from practice to practice, but there are always variations.
So backing up, and this might not, this is probably obvious to you, but to a lot of people who aren't as familiar with OSHA compliance, this probably isn't. What am I trying to protect myself from when I'm complying with OSHA?
Well, number one, it's the law.
Okay.
The two game changers in the dental industry was hepatitis and HIV.
Okay.
That's when OSHA became a big deal in the dental
industry.
There's
been some cases where that kind of must have been, triggered a big movement then. Yeah.
Yes. I dealt with a dental practice just last week in Houston, where a dental assistant took a patient that was Hep C positive. When she was taking the instruments from the operatory into sterilization to break down that tray and have those instruments cleaned, she neglected to wear her utility gloves.
Oh, wow.
She got a dirty stick. And, you know, just to show you that old man Murphy's alive and well, this happened with instruments that were used on a patient that has hepatitis C.
Yeah, that's tough.
Perfect storm.
Yeah.
That happens more often than
people realize.
You would care to think.
Yep.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask you some questions that seem like I have no clue what you're talking about, just because there are these are questions that I know a lot of people have, and you've just spent so long talking about it that it probably is something that goes over some people's heads. So I'm trying to bring up the kind of the obvious first issue is there's a lot of cases of employees who contract disease or illness through lack of sterilization, through lack of proper protections, and that's not only harmful to them, but it causes a lot of liability for you as a practice owner.
Yeah. Yes, it does. Let's talk about one common misperception that practice owners have. They get infection control and exposure control mixed up. There's a lot of crossover there. Exposure control is an OSHA issue. In other words, OSHA could give a rip if every patient you treat dies. They don't care about that. They really don't.
Okay.
All OSHA cares about
employees.
Is your employees.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So the flip side is your state board of dental examiners, they care about the patient's well-being.
Yeah.
So there's infection control, exposure control, and they do meet and cross over a lot, but a lot of folks just don't get the distinction.
Yeah. And which body regulates which issue?
Right. So OSHA regulates exposure control. The Board of Dentistry and you know, the Board of Dentistry follows CDC guidelines on infection control.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of overlap there. But yeah, you got two competing bodies.
Tell me a little bit about what are some, you know, I know you guys have inspected a lot of dental practices over the years, and what's the most kind of egregious issues that you've seen? Maybe something a little strange or even funny that you've seen that needed to be adjusted. I know there's a story out there.
Well, how much time do we have?
Yeah, we have time for my producer's telling me we have 7 hours for this interview.
7 hours.
Mm. Just kidding.
That may be enough. No. Well, you know, we've inspected over 700 dental practices around the country, and I guess I would start it out by saying I've seen stuff that'll curl your hair.
All right.
Probably the most egregious actually happened not long ago, but I went into a practice, and I actually did this one myself. The practice owner's about 55 years old, so he's been practicing 30 years. Went in, and he had never done any spore testing.
Okay.
Never, ever.
Wow.
Do you know the significance of that?
That's a very, very, very egregious thing.
Very egregious. Oh, man. So the CDC says dental practices should be spore testing minimum once a week. Minimum. Most practices do it several times a week. And so here's what spore testing is for the great unwashed. Yeah. You have an autoclave or autoclaves where you sterilize your instruments in between patients. Yeah. The only way that you can tell that it's sterilizing them properly is to do a test. And you use spores of bacteria and you put it in there and you'll run the cycle and you'll either send it off to be tested or you can actually test it in your own office. Yeah. And in 24 hours, you can get the results back and you'll know that autoclave is working properly. So it's a big deal. There was an oral surgeon in Tulsa a few years ago. It made the front page of most of the major metropolitan newspapers. He ended up having 53 patients who tested positive for hepatitis because he wasn't properly sterilizing his instruments.
Wow.
I don't even think he'd get a job as a Walmart greeter now.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, protocols once a week, but I mean, what do you think is most common? Like, do you think it's a common offense or something that most people have dialed in now?
Most people have that dialed in, but what is it they say about assuming?
Yeah.
It makes an ass out of you and me. Can I say that?
Yeah, you can. You know, only because my grandpa always says that, you know. So tell me about some other issues that you feel like maybe less obvious, you know, but things that, or some more obvious ones. But I just want to hear some more compliance violations that you feel like you bump into once in a while that are you in your audits.
Probably the most common is staff not wearing the proper personal protective equipment, lab jackets, gloves, masks, eye protection. It's a moving target, if you will.
Yeah.
I tell folks, it's really easy to get a dental practice OSHA compliant. Where the heavy lifting comes in is keeping it that way, because there are so many moving parts and pieces in a practice that you can be perfect today and it looks like a train wreck.
It's like putting on your seatbelt. You know, it's like, well, it's good and I remember and I go for a few weeks doing it and then I forget and then I miss a day or two, and that day or two could be the day that the problem happens.
Right. And the challenge that goes along with that is you've got a practice owner who's, you know, their focus is good patient outcomes.
Yeah.
They want to make sure that patient has a good experience and they do a great job for them. So if they're in an operatory and they've got their hands in someone's mouth, the last thing they want to be worrying about is what is Susie doing in sterilization or what is an associate doing in another operatory. They can't be everywhere at once.
This might be a little technical, but some of our listeners for the first time are going to be trying to put these protocols together. So if I have a hygienist who's wearing gloves and they have a lab jacket on, but they don't have eye protection, is there like locations in my practice where they need to wear their eye protection or have to have gloves on, or they have to have it all the time? Like, when do they have to have all those, that protective gear?
Basically, it's anytime there's potential for splatter.
Yeah.
On the clinical side of things, if they're in an operatory where they're doing anything other than a basic consult, so any procedures that are going on or anything going on in the sterilization area, they should have on full
protective gear,
PPE. So that means we're talking lab jacket with, you know, sleeves all the way down to your wrist, up to your neck, a mask over your mouth, eye protection, and gloves.
Yeah.
Exam gloves in the operatory. Once you get into sterilization, you put on those utility gloves.
Yep.
They're a little thicker, so that when you're handling instruments, you're not going to get a poke.
Yeah. So tell me how many people you think follow that procedure, because I've been in a lot of hygiene exams in my life as a patient, And I know there's, in some cases, in most cases, they'll wear a mask. A lot of times they don't have eyewear. And most of the time they'll be wearing gloves, but I've had cases when that's not been the situation. How common do you think it is for a hygienist to maybe comply with that? If you had 10 exams, 10 audits you did, just randomly, anecdotally, how do you think you'd respond to that?
I would say 98% of them have on gloves and a mask and eye protection. Okay. 50% have on a lab jacket.
Okay.
And when you get into sterilization, you're looking at probably 3/4 of them have on gloves, 25% have on mask and eye protection, maybe 10% have on a lab
Interesting.
Jacket. It's bad.
Yeah. So what do you, as an OSHA compliance consultant, how do people do random, because if someone knows they're being reviewed, or if you ask them the questions, you know, like if I'm a practice owner, I hire you to do this audit. Mm-hmm. But if I have you talk to my staff, I don't know that you're getting like objective feedback, because they're going to say, if you ask me, do I wear a lab jacket in the sterilization room? Am I going to say most of the time or some of the time? I'm just curious if there's random audits that can take place in order to just examine that.
Yeah. Yes. So when we do a full-blown assessment, especially the first time, and then we'll come back and we'll do an annual assessment where when we go into the office, they know we're coming. And you're right.
They're on their best behavior.
They're on their best behavior.
Yeah.
But still, sometimes, what will be funny is they'll come out and they'll go, Lee, I know I'm supposed to have so-and-so on, but I'm behind right now.
Yeah, okay.
So they know. And what we try and do is, because we've been exposed to so many different practices and so many different styles of operating, we're able to come in and share examples with them. Because a lot of these folks, they've only practiced in 2 or 3 practices maybe. So their worldview, if you will, is limited.
Yep.
Whereas we've been out in 700 and we've seen the good, the bad, and the ugly. And we can share those experiences so that they get a greater appreciation of the fact that sometimes stuff happens that they've never even heard of. Because most practitioners, they'll go through their whole career and never have a problem.
Yeah. Is it legal for me to put a camera in my office to do a random audit like that? Because if I see Lee walking in, I'm thinking this big football player coming into my office, he definitely looks like a compliance guy. I'm not gonna not wear my lab coat or thick gloves in my sterilization room if you're standing there doing an audit. Like, hey, just watching me go in there. But how do you do how can I really test whether my hygienists and my assistants are doing
what they're supposed to be doing? So in addition to our normal annual assessments,
which are normally done by the phone, right? Or
no, it's we're in the office.
Okay.
We're eyes
so
and
physically,
ears, mouth closed.
I mean I didn't know if you go and repeat it every year or if you just do that initially. Okay.
But there's another wrinkle to it. We come in at least once or twice a year. In addition to that, we come in unannounced.
Oh, okay.
So we see how they really
live. Right. But they still see you coming in.
Well, they see us coming in.
Sneak around. You hide in the cabinets. Okay.
And, we have a good enough relationship with people that, that they don't get up in arms.
Yeah, yeah.
Matter of fact, in some places, it's almost a joke.
Yeah. I'm just more curious about whether I could assess it completely randomly. But, the point of this isn't to catch people in gotcha moments, just to encourage the overall competency and literacy of your staff and build this as a team. You just wonder, if it's, I think if you randomly audited people's seatbelt usage, that'd be very different than if, they're sitting in the car with a cop every time they got in. We don't behave as, it's not easy to remember to do things the right way when we're not being reminded. So let's say that outside of an audit, how do I keep my staff remembering to stay on top of these protocols and make that part of our daily operation? How do I do that, you know?
Well, there are a couple of ways. We have a little formalized way with our clients. We deliver all of our training through the internet. We've trained over 1 million employees worldwide through our system.
Great.
And so in addition to the annual safety training you have, we also have monthly safety meeting modules. They're little 3 to 5 minute short little outtakes each month that they go through. They answer a short quiz, but then we also solicit input from them. It's almost like an electronic suggestion box, if you will. We can't be there all the time either, so we're counting on staff to be our eyes and ears.
Yeah.
So the agreement, we have an agreement with all of our clients, with all of our practice owners, that their staff can reach out to us anonymously at any time with a question or a concern. And we deal with it, and the practice owner knows we're going to deal with it, but we're never going to throw anybody under the bus, because the whole objective, you know, and the practice owner has to be in alignment with us on this, or we won't do business with them. The whole objective is to make sure at the end of the day that all the employees go home happy and healthy.
That's a great insight. Does a small practice and a doctor like in a rural area have as much risk as a multi-location doctor in a big city? I mean, you know, how do you kind of assess risk that way?
Well, from an OSHA standpoint, they're about the same. From a HIPAA standpoint, it's really interesting. If I had a dollar for every practice owner who has come up to me and said something like, "Well, Lee, you know, I live in Oskaloosa, Iowa, and I've got about 800 patients that have been patients of mine since I was knee-high to a grasshopper. Why in the world should I worry about HIPAA?" If I had a dollar for each one of those, I'd be on the beach, you know, sipping on one of those drinks with little tiny umbrellas in them. But the fact of the matter is, a practice owner in a little bitty small town with a little bitty practice, maybe they only have one hygienist and a part-time person up front, they actually have more risk from a HIPAA standpoint as a big practice, a big multi-doctor practice in a big city. And here's why. Number one, they don't have the resources to address those risks that a bigger practice has. They're going to spend a bigger percentage of their operating budget to cover that risk. It all boils down to this as far as HIPAA. Here's what you got to understand. If you gave me one of your credit cards right now, I don't care which one I don't care if it's got a $5,000 limit or a $50,000 limit. I don't care if you're over your limit. If you gave me that card right now, I could sell it in the next 5 minutes on the web anonymously. Want to know what I could get for it? A buck.
Nice. I didn't
know. let's say you have a pediatric dental practice, and I was able to get hold of one of the electronic health records of a 10-year-old patient of yours.
Okay.
I can sell that in the next 5 minutes on the web anonymously.
Okay.
Know what I can get for that?
How much?
Anywhere from $750 to $1,000.
Why? I'm asking.
I'm so glad you asked, my friend.
Why?
Well, it's actually pretty simple when you think about it. When's the first time someone runs a credit check on you?
When you're 18.
When's the first time you can borrow money?
About the same time.
Just when you're 18. Most people don't file a tax return until they're 18. Yeah. So if it's a 10-year-old patient, I've got an eight-year window in which I can use that protected health information, and I probably will not be discovered.
Yeah.
So let's take it a step further. Let's say a group of friends and I decide we're going to try and run a storefront clinic to do Medicare fraud. I've got to have records of real people to be able to plug in as patients. So if I've got 8 years to use that health information, that's worth a lot of money to me.
That's true.
So if you've got, and this is the point, I explain this to practice owners, and this is the point where the deer in the headlights look.
Yeah.
Comes because that all of a sudden they realize, and you can see them, they're doing the math. Okay, I've got 2,000 patient records at $1,000 a record. Oh my God, that's $2 million.
That's better than, that's more than my practice is worth.
And
legit,
and,
like in a legitimate and, sense.
And it's not in a safe. Yeah. It's sitting there. I can put it all on that little USB thumb drive. So all of a sudden, they're not just a practice owner. That's not the only, you know, they wear the hat as a dentist. They're wearing a hat as a practice owner. And now they just realize there's another hat they're wearing. They're a branch bank manager. The only problem is their liquid assets are not in a safe. Yeah. They're exposed to, you know, God and everybody.
Yeah. Well, you feel, they probably feel like a lot more responsible knowing that and thinking about it in that context too. You have a big responsibility too.
If they don't have their head in the sand. Yeah. And that's one of the big challenges right now.
Trying to get them to take a, understand how big of a responsibility that is.
Right.
Yeah, well, and I think that kind of just that emphasizes the importance of why HIPAA compliance is such a big deal as well.
It's huge.
Well, tell me a little bit about what fines and penalties look like for OSHA and HIPAA compliance. You know, tell me what fines look like. What am I looking for? Because I don't really want to do any of this stuff, so I'm just trying to figure out how much I'm going to have to write the check for.
Well, couple of facts on the OSHA side first. Okay. About 60% of OSHA inspections come from anonymous complaints.
Okay.
They can come from a number of places. They can come from disgruntled employees. They can come from disgruntled ex-employees. They can come from ex-girlfriends, ex-wives, competitors.
There's a
down
few
the street.
Of those. That's a problem.
Yeah. Well, and here's the thing. When OSHA receives a complaint, by law, they are charged to investigate. Now, there's a couple of different ways they can do that. They have choices. So if it really sounds completely off the wall, you may get a phone call or you may get a letter first. But 95% of the time, the first thing you're going to know about is it's going to be like when Mike Wallace shows up with a crew from 60 Minutes. You know, your administrator is going to walk back and say, "Hey, Dr. Reese, there's an OSHA inspector out in the front waiting room." And your day is just gone to you know where.
Well, I would be excited, but I'm unusual that way. No.
So the last year I have records for is 2015. The average number of violations on an inspection of dental practices was four violations. First time violations with OSHA can be up to $12,000 per violation.
Okay.
Now, having said that, I've never seen a $12,000 violation in a dental practice. But let's say your inspector's having a really bad day. I mean, they're human. And they come in and they tag you for four violations and they're only $5,000 each. It's $20,000.
Yeah.
But that's not the big problem. The big problem is now you're on their hit list for the next 5 to 7 years. It's just like if you have an IRS audit and they find a bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, that's a target-rich environment.
Yes.
So,
how many are inspectors? They cover regions, or do you know? Are they? Is it all national?
Yes. No. It's
regional.
Regional.
So, what's the likelihood of an audit? Like, is everyone? You know, are they supposed to be audited every 5 years? Every 3 years?
No. You've got about. Well, there's a twist in there, but. The smooth figures, not counting complaints, are you've got about the same odds of getting an OSHA inspection as you do an IRS.
Okay.
Audit. Now, so the big $64,000 question is the complaint.
Yeah.
Anonymous complaints drive 60% of them. So that
drives a lot. I mean, the securities industry is the same way. SEC investigations, state securities boards. I mean, they run mostly off of anonymous complaints.
Yep.
Yeah. Yep. Some not so anonymous. But I call in and complain a lot. Just kidding. So ultimately, I mean, it can be really expensive. Are penalties for HIPAA violations similar, or is that different?
Yes. And let me just carry this, if we've got time, let me carry this forward on the OSHA side first. So that's the first violation. They can be up to $12,000 each.
Okay.
Subsequent times, if they come in and do a second inspection, and let's say the first inspection, they got you for a bloodborne pathogens violation. If they come in on the second inspection and they see the same bloodborne pathogens violation, now we're not talking about a maximum of 12,000 anymore. Now we're talking about a maximum of 120,000.
Interesting.
Per violation. So the bigger problem is not the price of the violation. The bigger problem is what it portends for you in the future. So it's kind of like getting your first DWI.
You don't want to get your first one
because the second one, it gets really ugly. I have no personal experience of that.
Yeah.
So what happens is this. It opens a whole can of worms because that first bloodborne pathogens violation. So there are three types of OSHA violations. There are serious, other than serious, and willful.
Okay, so willful would be the...
Willful's the nasty. So that first bloodborne pathogens violation, that's going to be a serious violation. Mm-hmm. Well, if they come back, let's say 2 years later, and they hit you with that same bloodborne pathogens violation, now it's not a serious violation anymore. Now it's willful. And here's the problem with that. You carry workers' comp insurance, right? As a practice owner, you carry it for a couple of reasons. To protect your employees, but it's also to protect you and your practice. Because you can't be sued if you've got workers' comp. Well, there's a caveat to that. It's called willful negligence. Mm. If an employee or an employee's attorney can prove willful negligence, that breaks down what they call the workers' comp shield.
Interesting.
So that's why, you know, our whole goal is to never have that first violation.
Makes sense.
That you don't have to go down that road.
Well, that's a great kind of summary, man, to kind of wrap the idea of OSHA compliance up. Any parting thoughts you'd like to leave with Dennis about this OSHA compliance and kind of the overarching importance?
Don't put it off and don't downplay it. It's important. I would submit to you that the employees are the most valuable assets in the practice. They can make you or break you. And, you know, having them know that their practice owner has their back and wants to make sure they're operating in a safe way so that they go home happy and healthy at the end of each day, it speaks volumes.
Yeah, it does. Builds the right culture, makes everyone optimistic and feel like they're valued. I think it just, the way you take care of compliance says a lot about, it sets a tone for the quality of the business you're going to run. And I think this is just a way that really helps employees have confidence in you as a manager as well. So,
yep.
All right, Lee, this was a blast. I'm gonna hold you over one of these days for our conversation about football, okay? And how Alabama and Auburn can still root for both of those teams living in Alabama on a day when they're not playing each other. All right.
I look forward to
that.
Lee,
thank you so much. I really appreciate all the time and look forward to having you back on the show soon.